Show Me the Way podcast. Show Me the Way, episode 33, the hat trick specialist. Ladies and gentlemen, a real interesting opportunity for you. We're going to talk to a businessman who sold, then bought, then sold, and then bought, with some explanation in all of that, over the last 3 years, from 2020 to 2023. Don't know anyone else that's done that. And he's going to tell you in that short period of time what it was like to go through from two sides of a transaction to where he is now. Very interesting. I think there's a lot to learn you can take to the bank. Please be prepared for Matt Slauson. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain LLP about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I am your host, Dave Sider. Joining me on today's show is Matt Slauson. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, go back in time. Go way back in time. It was either the third, fourth, or fifth podcast that we had Matt. And there is so much has taken place in his recent business life that even though we talked to him before, I decided it was time to reconnect. And after you listen to the podcast, I think you'll understand why I decided to have him back on the show. Matt, welcome back.
Thanks, Dave. Great to be back.
Now, I think we need to do this for the first time listeners, is do a little bit of a background. Give us some flavor again. Where you're born and raised, where you went to school, so people can get to know Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born here in Kansas City, raised most of my life here, moved away for a bit, spent some time overseas, as well as Indianapolis, but went to school to study civil engineering, decided I didn't really enjoy telling other people how to build things, so ended up shifting gears into computer science. It was a little more fun to build things. However, kind of came back to the construction side of things. I've spent most of my career in the concrete asphalt maintenance worlds. As we talked about on the last podcast, quite the journey from working at a concrete company into eventually owning an asphalt maintenance company.
Excellent. That'll kind of bring us up to 2020 in a manner of speaking.
Absolutely.
What happened in 2020? This is kind of like you had a reverse COVID experience. Everyone else is slowing down, and you were speeding up, frankly.
Yeah, so a lot more details in that first episode that we recorded way back when, to be sure. But what happened in 2020 was I had helped the owner of the company I was running. I was a GM for Paradise Asphalt, and we had a deal on the table for him to sell his business to a third party. Unfortunately, and you were part of this deal, February of 2020, you guys are redlining that APA, getting pretty close to getting that deal inked. And the buyer, like a lot of buyers, had some issues given this pandemic that feels like we've all since forgot about. But at the time, if you can rewind to early 2020, there was a lot of unknowns. And so that deal fell through. Like a lot of sellers, that owner was still very much ready to be done and sell his business. I know we've talked about that, Dave.
Yes.
And so we had a lot of conversations around what it looked like for me to buy that company, which was a quick, you know, flipping the head. I think we called the last one the 180. And so quickly went from seller to buyer.
Yes.
Was able to get that deal done. It actually closed right in January of 21. So, you know, we wrapped it up at the end of 20 and signed it in 21. Since then, a lot has occurred. You know, still we're kind of hanging on to that pandemic, but we kept seeing a lot of growth in the business.
You and then just jumped from being an employee to an owner.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was that like? I mean, just the jump. That's a little.
Yeah. Different. As you know, Dave, I had been an employee as a GM, but also had been a consultant. So I'd spent a lot of time helping others with their businesses, working with a lot of owners, which was a great experience. But there's nothing quite like having your name on the line, being the guy holding the bag, right? And so there is definitely a mindset shift, kind of that psychological shift that happens. And there's definitely a little bit more weight to things. You take a little bit more time considering some of those strategic decisions, things like that. So it was definitely a shift, but fortunately for me, it was a pretty smooth transition. It was a company I'd been running for several years and was able to build that team. And so it was a relatively painless transition, at least on my end. There's always a little bit on the seller's end. And if you were to talk to Bob Paradise and, you know, his transition, it's a little different as they kind of transition out. But overall, I think it was a pretty smooth transition. And we continued the trajectory we were on and kept seeing continued growth within the company.
And so you're there minding your own business, running a company, going on to the next stage of life. And at this point, you thought you were going to probably run this company for what, 5, 10 years, or maybe the rest of your life? You really didn't know, did you?
I really didn't know. Yeah. And I think we talked about that. You know, I wasn't clear on what the timeline was. I did kind of have a feeling that it would be a 10-year kind of time frame. I didn't necessarily see it as the rest of my life, but I did think it was going to be a much longer hold than it ended up being. But I have a pretty diverse background. I like doing different things. And, you know, as opportunities come around, you always got to consider them. I think one lesson I've learned over the years is timing is everything.
And or lack thereof.
Or the lack thereof sometimes, right? But timing
That's
is
great.
Key.
That's so, great.
So, yeah, I mean, it was obviously a much shorter hold than those 10 years. And I'm sure we'll get into that transition and some of the differences and similarities going from selling, then buying, and then back to selling.
So you're part of the sales side, you're at the buy side, then you sold, and now you're buying companies for the owner of your entity. So I want to give them a timeline. And this is, you've had four changes. Is it even 3 years? That's about 3 years. No?
I think you could call it 3 years. Yeah, I think we can call it three at this point.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know anybody that's gone through that much in that short period of time. I don't know if there's some type of medicinal herbs that you're taking, or I mean, that's a lot of changes. Let's start here real quick. Let's go directly from you were part of the sell team to the buy team, and then you sold again. About what time period was this? This is 21.
Yeah, so the timelines are important. So, you know, we were selling in 20.
Right.
I bought very beginning of 21, and then I sold at the end of 22.
Okay.
And so it's been about, you know, depending on when this airs, a half a year to a year since I've sold. And now in the new role as part of a parent company, we are buying and acquiring more entities and then focusing on integrating those in and continuing that growth. So yeah, that's kind of 20 sale, 21 buy, 22 sale, 23 buy, I guess.
I
don't know.
That's fantastic. I honestly don't know of anyone who's been through that kind of a ringer. So congratulations to you. So let's go back here for a minute. You're on the sell side. When you're on the sell side back in 20, how did you get prepared for it? What was your mindset? Because you did most of the work, as I recall.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, fortunately there, and you know, it kind of started in 19 and bled into 20, but it was, you know, what I'd call the pre-pandemic timeline, and deals were plentiful. Things, valuations were up. There was a lot of activity. And more specifically, as you know, every industry is a little different. The private equity market kind of rises and falls, but each industry kind of acts within its own bubble. And in our space, being the pavement maintenance space, there was a lot of consolidation taking place. And so we went into it like we go into a lot of deals on the consulting side by best preparing the buyer for all that the deal encompasses. It's much more than, you know, as your listeners probably know by now, given the number of episodes and the content, the great content you've been able to produce, they've gotten a sneak peek. But it's a very arduous process to go all the way from putting yourself out there to be sold to actually closing a deal and then integrating into the new entity. So I would say it was probably, you know, high level, and then we can get into specifics, more of a seller's market in 1920.
Yes,
it was much easier, much quicker. I think pace is another big piece. Mm-hmm. I've seen a change in speed. You know, as you go into 22, 23, I'm seeing kind of a few differences there.
When you say speed, you're seeing it speed up or slow down?
It's moved so quick, Dave. Mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, we're talking here in July of 23. I would say the first half of this year, I kind of saw a bit of a slowdown.
Right.
When I say a slowdown, there were still deals getting done. They just, I think it was much more the strategic buyer than the right. financial buyer.
Right.
And I think they were a bit more selective than they probably were in 19. They're looking yes. under the hood a little bit more. They're being a little bit more cautious. I find that they're quicker to buy the smaller guys and some of the bigger giants that were getting scooped up in 19. The speed at which that's happening in the first half of 23, from my experience, and everybody's different, was much slower. And obviously there's a lot of market conditions we could discuss that might be impacting some of that. But all that said, and I don't want to look too far ahead, but I do feel like it is kind of picking back up again here in the middle of 23. And I think there's a decent outlook for the second half. Valuations may be down just a bit, but it does seem like there's still activity going on out there.
You know, I think your diagnosis is spot on. I saw it slow down. I saw maybe not so much the valuations change that much, but people are looking a lot more closely at deals. They become more risk concern. I remember the go-go days of, you know, about 2014 to 2020. There's so much money flying around. It would just get the deal done. In the last couple of years, I think, to your point, and specifically this year, this change, there's a lot more caution to all of this. Also, some structural changes. It was easy to get cash up front back a few years ago. It's harder to get all of that cash up front right now. Let's talk, though, a little bit about, and I do think it is going to speed up here at the end of the year.
No, and you're right. I think deal structure, you kind of touched on it, but that's something I've seen a big shift in this year as we look to acquire even and others in the space. The days of 95, 90, 100% cash, they're, I don't want to say they're gone because you'll still see it on occasion, but the structure has very much changed. So that's a great observation.
But I do see it a lot more activity. I've seen it in my own practice really over the last 60 days. It just kind of accelerated. So why, I don't know. I think that a lot of people have become a little bit more optimistic. And supposedly, we're out of the bear market. I don't know when they declared that, which is not to say we can't go back into the bear market. But I also sense the stock market is going to do what it did, you know, years and years ago. It's not going to fluctuate a lot. We're going to be hanging around from 32 to 35.
Mm-hmm. You know, it'll stay pretty tight.
Yeah, I think it's going to be pretty tight. So you went from a sell side, you're getting everything put together, you're trying, you know, to get that ready, to the buy side. Well, kind of unique because you knew what was going on the sell side, so the buy side was pretty easy. Then you go back to the sell side again in 2022.
Yeah.
And a lot of the same issues come up, different issues, so to speak. I imagine that it was probably just all one and the same, so to speak. It wasn't really any different. You're just doing it over again?
I think it's a little different. You know, I think the biggest difference you kind of asked in becoming an owner, I mean, keep in mind, when I was selling in 19, I was selling on behalf of someone else.
Right.
Like, it wasn't truly my sale. So that probably gave me a little bit of an advantage to disconnect emotionally from the process of the deal. I think doing it in 22, obviously there's the market difference and the economics of it, but I think the biggest difference for me is now all of a sudden, and a great experience, but I'm wearing the hat that I've come alongside in the consulting realm of so many others, and now I'm walking through it. So I think it's very fortunate that I'd seen enough deals from the consulting side of what it looks like to be on the sell side, but all the things that you and I've talked about, still very much, I'm not immune to them, right? Deal fatigue and just kind of sticking to your numbers and going through the process. Like, it's everybody's got to do it. And so it was different in that regard, but I think the process, very similar, still a fair amount of interest in the market and the consolidation. So that helped. And timing, like I said, the timing was just right.
And now you flip back to the buy side. So you can take what you've learned from trying to sell, then buying, and then selling. So do you feel like you have a pretty good, I imagine you have a very good idea of what a seller is going through. So you could probably bring a new dynamic to the table that maybe you didn't a few years ago. And what would that look like?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting piece. You know, I was just down south working on a deal with the team. You know, obviously I'm part of a much bigger organization now, so it's nice to be part of a team that has experience in it. But the unique perspective that I was able to bring as we're talking to a potential seller is, you know, as he has questions about what changes are going to occur, mm-hmm. as he has questions about the structure of the deal, as he has questions about post-close integration and his team and these things, I'm able to speak to that now having gone through it. And we laugh, but recently having gone through it, right? Not that long ago, I walked through all those same things. So it does provide a unique perspective to those going through it. And yeah, I definitely feel like I know what it's like to be in that chair and continue to learn from the buy side as well. But I think they both complement each other really well, because now I can look at the sell side from the buy side and vice versa.
So back in 2020, you had to do somewhat your own integration. And I'm going to define integration as when you buy a company and you are bringing it into, in real world terms, a mothership or another entity. You have to put people together. But even in 2020, when it's the same company, you're the new owner. And so you look at things differently. Was that a struggle for you to get everybody on board, or was it pretty seamless?
Fortunately, I'd been given a lot of leeway in the 18 to 24 months prior to that transaction. So I feel like the team was behind me from a leadership perspective. Mm-hmm. But there were definitely some minor changes, some things we approached a little differently from a culture perspective, you know, kind of shifted to, we have an off season here in the Midwest in the paving industry. It's real hard to lay asphalt when it's December in Kansas City. So we go to a 4-day work week. Little changes like that, I brought in to help create that work-life balance and reward the team for the efforts they put in during the hot summer months when we're really riding at our peak. Right. But all in all, I think that quote-unquote integration, especially based on your definition, was pretty smooth, because it was an existing entity that I had been running, and now it's an existing entity that I'm running and owning. And so there were definitely some changes, but it was probably the smoothest as I could have envisioned it.
Then in 22, you're selling again. And I assume in that process, 22 to 23, you're helping to integrate. What have you learned from that experience that you could share with us?
Yeah, that's a huge piece. I think there's a lot to pull back on the integration topic. I feel, just starting off, that integration often gets overlooked in a lot of the conversations you and I have with individuals, because we're so hyper-focused on the process of getting a deal done. And so for most people, and rightfully so, that is the finish line. But when you're looking at it from the buy side, and this is important for those listening that are on the sell side as well, because you need to understand what the person across the table wants, integration is key, because anybody buying is buying to integrate and then maximize, you know, the return on their investment. Right. And so I've always known integration is a key piece, but I've been able to experience it firsthand in two very distinct roles. One, having gone through it with Paradise, rolling into the parent company, Atlantic Southern, and walking through their integration process. We kind of were integrated, so to speak. But then as part of my role with the new entity, I'm helping, as part of the integration team, change policies, procedures, softwares, things like that as we acquire. And we have since acquired a company down in Dallas. And so it was a great experience for me to take what I'd learned months prior going through integration and then helping kind of continuously improve our integration process and bring a little more structure to it. But I think it is a very, very important piece for all these industries that are getting consolidated. We're seeing a lot of private equity activity. And I talk to a lot of people in other industries and in the construction industry as well. And I know companies that are in roll-up mode that have acquired 4 companies and struggle with integration. And I know companies that have acquired 30 companies and still haven't figured out integration. Right. So it's very much an ongoing piece that a lot of people are struggling through.
Do you have a feeling how long that takes? Because I'll be honest with you, I don't know if there's an answer that I'm familiar with You know, it seems like it takes years, but maybe that's just me being me.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the 80-20. I think the years is probably to get 100% integrated, because you're talking about culture integration. You're talking about people, processes. I think from the day-to-day, you know, changing reporting and changing the way you approach certain things, you know, we really strive to get the big milestones knocked out anywhere between 90 and 180 days. So really 3 to 6 months is kind of the time frame to, again, that 80-20. There's probably still 20% left to do, but 80% is enough to kind of get them humming and running along. And you can't force too much change too quickly, because for even those of us like myself that go through a lot of changes, people, humans are just change averse by nature, and it doesn't always go smooth. So
I don't think it ever goes smooth. I think you're being generous there. So you obviously had some other, well, you had some deal fatigue and going from one side to the other side to the one side to the other side. There's always in every acquisition what I call deal fatigue. It sets in somewhere. I never really know. How did you deal with deal fatigue, especially doing essentially 4 deals in 3 years, more or less?
Yeah. So you and I talked about deal fatigue last time, and it's a concept I also genuinely believe in and can confidently say I've seen 100% of the time on the deals I've been a part of. I really appreciate the question, Dave, even as you and I were talking the other day, in that I always look at deal fatigue in the single transaction. I look at deal fatigue when you're negotiating that APA and you're months into it and you're tired. A lot of owners are tipped over. But your question kind of struck me in the sense of, I haven't looked at deal fatigue in the, what, 4 deals or however many deals it's been in a 3-year time frame. And, you know, if I stop and reflect on it, it's definitely stressful. How you handle that stress is important, but there's probably no question. I mean, you kind of joked, you know, Matt, does that a few years to where you're at?
And right.
It probably does. I mean, you know, my wife might be a better person to answer that question, having, you know, she's been able to see it from all the way through, but I kind of thrive in it, but I don't think that negates the tolls of the stress and just the amount of work. So yeah, I think I definitely experienced it on the one-off within the most recent transaction, but I think there is probably a little bit of a toll. But candidly, I think, you know, that toll's worth it. And I think while it might have added a couple years here, I think it probably gave me a couple years on the back end somewhere. That timing is everything. But no, deal fatigue is very real. And the best thing sellers can do is prepare for it, because it will come at some stage in the process.
Do you have any, I don't know if you want to say memorable transactions, but maybe memorable moments that just resonate with you that you would like to share? You know, just either learning something or a special relationship that was created, or I hate to say it this way, something you'll never do again if you see it coming down the horizon. You know, I hate to say this, with a couple of deals, I'm going like, guys, there's a train coming. I'm telling you, I can see the train. You go, really? You go, yeah, I've been on this track before. Have you learned anything along those lines you could share?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've learned a ton. I know last time we talked about it, I see so many companies looking to sell or waiting to sell. And I think peak value, which we discussed in length last time, is still a very real concept that people running their business must keep in front of. You have to build the business in a way that you're going to sell it, even if you're not going to sell it. Focus on the enterprise value, and then be honest and be real with what you want as an owner. Do you have in your tank what it takes to take that company from where you're at on terms of peak value to another level? And a lot of people think they do, and then they don't. And then I see them 3, 4, 5 years later reaching back out and saying, hey, I think I'm ready to sell now. And I'm like, oh, how much did you grow it since we last talked? You know, I'm expecting EBITDA to have taken a jump, and it's less or the same as where it was. So I think understanding that peak value is an important lesson. There's other pieces of advice I've kind of picked up along the way, which we can touch on. But I think as far as the biggest, most memorable takeaways, it often comes to people. I mean, just being able to help individuals get to that next chapter of their life when they don't know how to do that. I've been fortunate to keep a lot of those relationships. And on the consulting side, you know, to have guys much older than I, just so grateful to be able to experience that next chapter of their life, has been pretty cool. I stay in touch with a lot of them, and you know, they truly enjoy the season that they're in. You know, even personally for me, Bob Paradise, you know, we still grab lunch, grab coffee, good. And he just loves what life looks like for him now, and he's grateful that, you know, I was able to be a part of that, and it's cool to see that impact.
Good. That's fantastic. So you would say more likely than not that you have grown as a seller from 2020, where you were, to 2022. And I don't know, you may not be a seller again anytime soon, but that you've evolved in that regard. But let's talk from a buy side. Now, how have you evolved as a buyer? Let's talk about 2021 now to 2023.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously buying in 21, fortunately, was a pretty straightforward process for me, because when we talk about due diligence, that tough stage of the deal when everybody's mm-hmm. looking under the hood, I had been running Paradise for so long that it made that process pretty easy.
Easy, right.
But now as I look at where we're at and we look at buying companies around the country, it takes a much different perspective. You know, I probably took it for granted back in, now even my dates are getting confused, and back in, you know, 21 when I purchased Paradise. But a lot is still being learned. You know, I'm part of a great team, got private equity that we work with, and just learning what they're looking for from a valuation standpoint, from a financial standpoint. But I think most importantly, what I've learned over the last year is the people side and the process side.
Interesting.
I see so many of these buyers, you know, want a list of financial reports and ready to do a deal, and rarely have a great grasp for the teams that they're buying. And depending on the industry, but I would argue a lot of industries, people are a big part of what you're buying. Most businesses, despite our trajectory with AI and automation, there's still a people component, right?
Right?
So especially in the construction space. And so I think doing a bit of due diligence on that and really understanding the team and then the motives of those in the leadership team. I think far too often in transactions, and I'd be curious your thoughts on this, Dave, from the legal side, but there's not enough transparency or communication amongst the people involved on what they want post-transaction, who's going to stay, who's going to go. And I think those are really important conversations to ensure success in that next stage through integration. So there's a lot I'm still learning. There's a lot we could talk through on, you know, how it's evolved on the buy side, but I think that's one element that certainly jumps out at me.
I think, you know, to your point, in all of our businesses, I say this about the law, which I dearly love, but I'm essentially an artisan or a craftsman or a tradesman. I've got a license. I'm really not that much different in many respects from a welder or an electrician. The question is, what do you do with it? And because of that, I believe I'm in a people business at a law firm. And I think that applies. I think I've learned hanging around guys like you and other folks. You're really in a people business. So you want to figure out, now that you've got the basic groundwork of skills and have an ability to, you know, create some value, how do you in turn deliver it up in such a way that people, you know, come to you, and either as an employee or as a partner in my case, or as a client, you know, you can help them get to where, you know, you want to go. So I see a lot more time being spent there. But I'll be honest with you, I think it's been because I've hung around the business clients that I figured out that's really where mm-hmm. I need to spend time. And for myself, it's a little bit of a differentiation.
That's good.
Any other momentous transactions that you would say, wow, that was fantastic. I'd like to see that happen 100 times. I'm sure like me, every once in a while, you can look at a deal and go like, I'll never do that again, although you can't really predict it one way or the other. You love them all to be gems.
Right.
But I think right now, especially over the last few years, it's gotten tougher. You can still do deals. There's a lot of deals out there. They're structured differently. A little bit tougher now. I think before it was hurry, hurry, hurry. Now it's mm-hmm. like, let's turn over all the rocks. In 2 years, I don't know. You know, I don't know if we're going to go, if it's going to be an, you know, amalgamation of both or what.
No, it's moving quick. I think to your point, there's always those deals where they get done, but you know, it didn't always feel the best. I think I strive in every deal to create a win-win situation.
Right.
If someone's losing, the deal shouldn't be done. I think the hard part is time tends to be the best judge. And it's hard oftentimes 3 months, 6 months after a deal to really evaluate. You know, you can talk through how the process went and what some of those pain points were like.
Right.
But I think the outcome can take some time to really measure. But fortunately, I've been able to see a few deals now, and I can think of a couple that didn't go so smooth, but a few that really, they just synergized well, and they were able to capitalize on the complementary services that they offered, and the team stuck in there and worked through that change management of integration and really excelled. But that's on a deal I'm thinking of that was done, you know, 19 months ago. So it does take some time to see some of that.
You know, and I always think too, the dynamics of really being able to work with people on the other side can make it somewhat enjoyable or very painful. I always, you know, a couple of deals I've started, I said, it's my intention to try to make this joyful for everyone because it's going to be painful more often than not. So anything I can do to lessen the burden, let me know. If there's any better way to communicate, let me know. What can we do to at least have as much of what I call great conversations as is possible, knowing that, you know, they've got a job to do and I've got a job to do.
Yeah. I think the conversations are the key, and I think transparency goes a long way. As you know, from the legal side and the diligence side, I've seen a couple deals where people try and sell their way through it and maybe aren't the most forthright, if you will.
Right.
And, you know, the advice I always give to the clients that we consult with is simply, you know, be honest.
Yeah.
Because you're not doing yourself any favors to create one narrative on the front end. And then when they start peeling back the curtain, you quickly find out it's another narrative. It erodes the trust that is so crucial to get a deal done. You know the process better than most. And if there's not some level of trust, I just don't think the deal gets all the way through, and that's important because there's a lot of time and energy that goes and money that goes into these deals.
Well, and to your point too, you want to at least be honest so you can figure out if there are issues, how you're going to work through them. And you know, in one case recently, I told a client we're going to be in a dispute because you know we closed, but we know we don't have this issue resolved, but we can collar it and then try to figure out the best way, you know, to resolve it going down the road, knowing that there's the potential for, frankly, some disenchantment, whether it's legitimate or not. So we'll just figure it out from there. So you're part of a roll-up, and without disclosing, you know, confidences, where does your company see your industry going for the next 10 years? Because there's a lot of dynamic changes in construction generally. But let's talk about your specific space.
Yeah, so our space, you know, specifically the pavement maintenance, we're seeing a lot of, I can think of at least a half a dozen to 10 private equity groups that are actively consolidating within the space over the last couple of years. So we're starting to see a lot more attention and money get dumped into an industry that really hasn't been much of a focus. I think you're going to see, you know, construction, this is a broad generalization, but it typically lags a bit as technology advances sometimes. We're not always on the forefront. And I think we're going to continue to see technology, autonomous learning, and AI continue to impact our industry. And when I say impact, that could be directly. We're seeing things on the takeoff side of things to create quantities and help with the estimating process. Technology's come a long way there in the last couple of years. But I also think, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day in the space, and what we're seeing in terms of electric vehicles and autonomous driving, I think will greatly impact the pavement maintenance space because from, you know, I own an electric vehicle as well as a gas vehicle, and the weight of these vehicles is much, much heavier. And so that's going to impact the pavement maintenance, right?
Good
These
call.
Are the things that people don't always think about.
Yeah.
And while we can all joke about some of the autonomous driving that Tesla and others have out there, eventually, I am confident, not tomorrow, but eventually we'll reach a place where your car may very well drop you off at the store or at the grocery, and then go park itself and then come back and pick you up. So, you know, we do primarily parking lots. Well, parking lots could in time, and I'm looking out a ways, but could drastically change based on some of these things. So I think looking at technology and the industry, as well as more capital getting injected into the space through these consolidations, is gonna have a big impact on it. And we're already starting to see some of that. Obviously, the roll-up companies have different strategies in how to attack the space, and that kind of leads to different answers. But it's pretty wild to just see in such a short time the amount of change I've seen since 15 when I joined Paradise.
Yeah, I it's really interesting what you brought up, that especially with electric cars and with the batteries making them a lot heavier. Are we going to have self-driving cement trucks and self-driving pavement? Who knows?
I've seen remote operated loaders and pavers and things, and so I mean, it's all pretty early, but it could really impact. I'm seeing more technology. Just at the last pavement show, they've got machines that can do the crack sealing in streets with just one employee, one driver, which is normally a 3 to 4 person crew. So I think we'll start to see a lot more impact in time, but it's fun to watch and to see the growth.
I'm going to say, and then the other thing is, if we all have flying cars here pretty soon, then that's a whole nother phenomenon that I'm not sure how we're going to deal with.
I don't know if we're ready for that.
What's next for you in your life and personally?
Yeah, I mean, highest level, I want to just continue to learn. You know, I've always strived my whole life to just keep learning, and I feel like I'm in a great position to do that. I'm part of a team here with Atlantic Southern to continue to learn and grow, both on the acquisition and integration side. I think last time we spoke, I told you I was diving into some of the financial modeling and learning a little bit more on that realm. Not looking to get my CPA, but just continue to study all the aspects of these M&A transactions. And then I am still consulting, not quite as frequently as I was, but still very much helping others. I've got a couple deals right now that we're working on in the space and outside of it to help other business owners, you know, successfully exit their companies and apply the numerous lessons I've learned along the way. You know, we talked about some of those last time, but I think those pieces of advice can go a long way for those looking to sell.
So the million-dollar question, if you were to give somebody 2 to 3 pieces of advice, the top 2 or 3, and thinking now back what you said in 2020 versus 2023, would they be the same or different? And what would they be?
So I pulled up what I said in our last conversation, and I'll be brief here, but the three I touched on was start earlier than you think. Mm-hmm. Determine your number and stick to it, and then find a guide or trusted advisor. I still stand by all three of those pieces of advice. I would add 2 more to that list, and that is consider all your alternatives. And as a part B to that, don't tip over too early. And so the reason I kind of scrunched those together is a lot of people start the process to sell their business. They get a buyer that's interested. They maybe don't love the number, but the number will get it done. And they haven't really thought through, what are my alternatives to going down the path of this LOI or trying to do a deal with this potential buyer? What are my alternatives if I don't sell? What's the timeline if I build a leadership team or do an ESOP or whatever that may look like? And I think, you know, that's just a failure to plan. And I think taking a little more time to think through those alternatives actually helps you not tip over too early. Because unfortunately, for some people that don't have the trusted advisor, that didn't start early enough, that aren't firm in their number, they can, I don't want to say get taken advantage of, but they can quickly experience that deal fatigue and just throw up their hands and say, well, I don't care, I'm getting out. So I think, get your alternatives lined out. And then the other thing I will say, having gone through this a few times with others, and this probably applies a little more to those that are looking to stay in the space than, you know, a 65, 70-year-old that's going to quickly exit. But far too often, sellers don't ask enough questions of the buyers. And I'm sure you can speak to this in your experience on the legal side as well as observations from diligence. But I think while I may be somewhat unique in the number of times I've done this in the last few years, I don't think I'm unique in that you're going to find a lot more people of my generation, that cursed word we call millennials, that will not hold things as long and will be more apt to transition. And when that's the case, it's important to know, what are you transitioning to? What's the team you're becoming a part of? What's your role going to look like? What are the expectations? You know, it's a lot of mind shift going from an employee of a company, an owner of a company,
yes,
back to an employee, back to, you know, I mean, there's a lot of hopping around there. So I think ask a lot more questions than what I typically see.
Well, I think to your point, and ladies and gentlemen, he's not setting me up for what I'm about to say, but I love doing M&As. But what I've really found is this whole phenomenon is one of business succession planning, and you can't really start too soon. As I said, I think I was speaking at Hitachi or some franchise in front of a bunch of franchisees, listening to other people on a panel talk about M&As, and I came to the conclusion it's all very simple. I have stock in one hand, or membership interest, and money in the other hand, and all we're trying to do is hands. I mean, that's essentially it, and then I do what's in between. But to your point, do you really know that that is the best alternative for you personally in your life? And have you looked at the other options? So I've been spending much more time this year than ever before, and really over the last 14 months, helping people do assessments of where they are in their business and set out a business succession plan. You know, I need folks like you because I'm not going to do the cash flow analysis, for example, where they have to go and what they need to do, but lay out a path. Because I think at the end of the day, you get a lot more, in my mind, control out of your destiny. I don't think anybody controls all of it, but within some specter, you can have more Absolutely. Control than you have. Because once you're in an LOI, you're on down the road, basically. And most of the time, it's going to work out. And you're right. I've seen some people go, I quit. I'm done. I don't want to do it anymore. So, you know, let's wrap up the deal. Versus let's take a longer term plan. And I think one of the struggles, I'm going to say this especially for men, I'm not seeing it with as many women, but there are a couple that I can think of, it's an issue. But so many men define their lives by their business existence. And if you don't have a plan for what's next, you know, I think it becomes very difficult for all of us, including me. I'm coining the word for 2023 of don't retire, but rewire. And that is to say, we're all going to live now, whether we like it or not, because of medicine, to about 100. I think probably, I'll ask everybody to go back and look at it, a very old movie, I think it's from the 60s, early 70s, called Soylent Green.
Yeah, I actually know that movie, dude.
There you go. So I think, like that movie, I think they're going to cremate all of us and take the computer chips and the titanium and the steel rods out of us and use it for other people. And, you know, I truly believe we'll all live to be 100 if you want to. So what are you going to do from age 65 retirement on? And, you know, what is the quality of your life? And especially if you've been running a business, it's hard to shut off that brain. In fact, I would say you can't shut it off. So you got to go figure some things out. Well, Matt, again, great thoughts. Really one-of-a-kind experience. I can't speak to anybody else or bring anybody else to the table that has done what you've done in the last 3 years. So by definition, congratulations.
Thanks.
Best of luck. I mean, really an impressive run for you. And I know there'll be a lot more out there. How do people reach you? Especially because you are a consultant, you'd be willing to work with people, you and your partner, Jeff Stokes. So how do they reach you?
Yeah, I think probably the easiest way, LinkedIn, you can connect with me there. There's also the consulting side as well as the payment side. So Next Level Contractor is a consulting branch as well as Paradise Payment Maintenance for the payment company. But Matt Slauson on LinkedIn, happy to connect and answer any questions. It's been fun having people, even from our last conversation, Dave, reach out and say, hey, I heard this podcast. I'm looking at getting into the space and just Great. Having a conversation and kind of helping share what little I've learned. And yeah, happy to help any way I can.
Excellent. If you're in search of assistance, go to davesider.com and schedule a consultation or contact me at spencerfain.com. Also, please be sure to subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple. Ladies and gentlemen, great podcast. Look forward to you all tuning in next time. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners should consult with an attorney or their trusted professional on their distinct circumstances.